I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell.
Hello everyone, welcome back. Yeah, sorry we've been away, we've had a little break because we've been working out what to do next. We're celebrating 5 years of podcasting now. So yeah. we're going to, in the next 5 years, if I'm spared, we should do slightly differently. But Molly and I will certainly do two a month. And then I'm going to do one on my own about things I recommend in true crime and maybe some commentary on crime events going on as we speak, because there always seem to be really quite a lot. So I thought I'd try and do a little mix of recommendations for streaming or television or movies.
Things you've been watching.
Things I've been watching, and things that I've been reading as well. So, you know, all in a way, right, pertinent to what we've been doing. And the other thing I'm going to do in the other week of the month is I'm going to try and get an interview together with a really good author, be it an author of crime fiction or someone who writes about true crime or someone who is a policeman. You know, I thought
that's try a good
and
get idea.
Something, you know,
get like some of your like lawyer mates and stuff.
Yes,
barrister mates. Yeah, judge mates.
Yeah, I mean, to talk about, you know, what it's like.
Yeah.
So I thought quite an interesting.
That's great. That'd you know, be so fun.
And I thought it would just give it a bit more depth and maybe occasionally perhaps a bit more glamour.
Are you suggesting we're not glamorous?
No, I'm not suggesting we're not, but I'm suggesting a bit more. I didn't say. I think we're entirely glamorous, darling. but the truth of the matter is that sometimes you need to add a little sprinkle of gold dust or stardust, don't you? So there you go.
That's true. You're the stardust. Dad.
That's my
You're
plan.
You're the stardust.
My plan for the future. So welcome back. I got a number of rather concerned letters that we'd been away and... oh dear, are you all right? And is Molly all right? And I wrote back saying, yes, we're fine, thank you very much. But we were just having a little break. Oh, well, that's good. Oh, I really miss you. I had another one of those letters which said, you'll send me to sleep on a regular
I
basis.
I can't work out if that's a compliment or not.
I think it's a compliment.
Yeah.
I think it's a compliment.
Do you listen to anything when you fall asleep or do you just go for silence?
I
assuming
don't,
your neighbours aren't having a party.
I don't tend to listen to anything, no. I just tend to go to sleep.
Yeah.
Although I do read, of course. Mm. And I read, if I wake up in the night, I always read. And
when you wake up in the night, how long are you usually awake for? An hour?
An hour would be
longest,
I would have thought. Maybe half an hour. Maybe a bit less. I mean, sometimes if you're in a really busy period and when you've got a lot of things on your mind, then you tend to, you know, toss and turn and think and stuff.
Yeah.
Particularly when I'm doing as Molly knows, I've done a series of four programmes for Channel 5 on prisons, which essentially are anthologies of people who are in the prisons. And the trouble with that, which is wonderful, I really enjoy doing them, but there's such a lot of material.
Yeah.
And there's absolute mountain of material. And to try and remember it all, because you can't look down, you can't look at a note, it gets testing.
Yeah.
I mean, I love doing it. I'm very, very proud to be asked. But it can get to you. Because, you know, you might be talking about 8, 9, 10 cases. We talk about in one episode one case.
Yeah.
But if you're talking about 10 cases.
And we're not on camera, so you could look it up if you got notes if you need them.
Yeah. But you can't, you see. And one of the things about making a lot of television is that everybody's different. Every producer is different. Every director is different. Every cameraman is different. And they've all got a different, you know. Don't look at the lens. Look at the lens. Look at this mirror. Don't look at that. Don't look at me. Don't, you know, and you get to a point. Well, I think it's obviously because I'm not exactly young that you think, I don't know what to do next. You know, I'm completely at a loss here. But anyway, it seems to work. And I'm very grateful to be asked. And it's great fun to do, if sometimes a little taxing. A little taxing.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
We did have a break. We needed a bit of a break.
Yes, we did. And I appreciated it. And besides, Mo's been so busy. She's been rushing about and just been to Portugal.
I have just been to Portugal, yeah. For a wedding.
Was it nice?
Yeah, it was good fun.
Was it warm?
Yeah. It was windy, though, because we were on the coast.
Oh, right, okay.
Like at the bottom near Faro.
Near Faro, yeah.
Yeah. Quinta do Largo, which I think is just a place you go to play golf. Kite surf, I think.
Yeah.
It was more just sort of like constructed golf towns. Sort of interlinked.
Yes.
Not really my vibe, but we went to some nice places and we had a fun time, so.
Good. Well,
the wedding itself was great.
Oh, that's lovely. How smashing.
Yeah, it was good fun.
I really like the sound of that.
Be good fun.
I think I've only ever been to Portugal once, and that was with you.
Yeah. That was the last time I went to Portugal, and I was like 4 or something.
You weren't
not
old.
Even 4.
That's for sure.
2.
You were certainly young.
I was little.
You were a little one. And I went to cover the Portuguese Grand Prix.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, I like Lisbon. This is the only place I've really been, apart from Estoril, which is not that far from Lisbon. But Lisbon's very beautiful. But I'm not sure about the Portuguese character. That whole concept of fado, you know, that you are
a little
melancholy.
Oh, I see.
It's called fado.
Oh, okay.
And there is a sense in sometimes that you talked about Portugal that some people get a little sad. But I had a very nice call from somebody who lives there. All the time, or most of the time.
I'm not convinced in the bit of Portugal I was in there were that many Portuguese people.
Ah, they were all golfers.
Mm.
Yes. Well, it's a good place to go and play golf.
Yeah, lovely. Sure. Lovely.
Nice weather and...
Bit windy.
But on the other hand, if you like golf, you don't mind a bit of wind, do you?
You've got to play into the wind or against the wind or
against
whatever.
The wind or with the wind.
With the wind.
Yeah.
Anyway, wind factors into golf, doesn't it?
Wind's a big factor in golf. Actually, it's quite a big factor in cricket, if you're careful about it. Not so much in football, unless it's very, very windy.
So low to the ground.
Yeah.
The ball's too low to the ground for it to be. We've digressed. I think we should probably press
matter.
On.
But the other thing, Molly's been to Los Angeles as well, so...
I did, yeah.
And our producer is going to Los Angeles any moment, so...
Has she not gone already?
No.
Oh, no, yeah, she's going like tomorrow or something.
Wednesday, I think.
Oh, is it?
Anyway, I mean, so, you know, I feel a bit housebound, but I don't really want to go anywhere very much, I'm afraid. I'm quite happy here, providing there aren't any parties. So in the for this first of our new series, which series is it, 11?
I have no idea.
Neither have I. I know it's a lot. I thought I'd do a two-parter on arguably the most iconic gangsters in British criminal history. The Cray Twins.
The Cray Twins. How many times do you think they've been depicted in media?
Oh, many.
Entertainment.
Well, there was a movie called The Cray Twins with the Spandau Ballet Brothers, wasn't there?
There was one with Tom Hardy.
Called Legend, or was
when
it?
When he played both brothers.
Played both brothers. There's been a whole, string. They were absolutely iconic in the 1960s. Yeah. No one who remembers the 60s as I do can ever be in any doubt about their status as legendary. So
this is the Craze part one?
This is the Craze part one.
Great.
Just so everyone's well aware, Reggie and Ronnie Cray were twins. They were born on the 24th of October 1933 in Haggerston, which is in East London.
That's where I live.
Yes, not far at all. Reggie was born 10 minutes before Ronnie. Their parents, Charles and Violet. Charles was a wardrobe dealer.
Specific.
It is, very. But they did have an elder brother called Charlie, named after his father, who was born 6 years before they were, in 1927. And they had a sister, sadly died in infancy, called Violet, who was born 1929. They were much prized by Violet, their mother, and well brought up, I would say, it would be fair entirely to say. At the age of three, they both caught diphtheria, which is a bacteria infection, which was quite common. We're talking about 1936.
What does it do to you?
Well, it just makes you cough a lot. It can be fatal, but it isn't usually. It weakens the lungs. But in 1938, when they were both five, they moved from Haggerston to Bethnal Green, where they remained. They were quite a close family. Mum and Dad and their elder brother, Charlie, where they were close together. But during the Second World War, like many other people in East London, they were evacuated. They were sent out of London, which was then subject to bombing, to Hadley in Essex. It was the first time the twins, or indeed any of the family, had really ever encountered countryside. And they had rather a sort of nostalgic like for it. It was so quiet and it was so green. And it was rather sort of wonderful. But they didn't remain in Essex for very long. I think the father, Charles, had to remain and work, obviously. And so they eventually, within about a year, they came back to Bethnal Green, part of East London, which Molly and I both know, what you might describe as the old East End. It had been badly affected by the bombing during the Second World War. A lot of burnt out buildings, quite a lot of crime. People survived the East End, I think it would be fair to say. It wasn't the most cheerful environment. Anyway, they did, and all came through the war out the other side. And in 1952, they were both called up for what was known then as National Service. So I have to explain what National Service is, okay? In the wake of the war, we had asked everybody, every adult male over the age of 18, to serve a period of 2 years in the army or in the armed services. Could be the army, the air force, or indeed the navy. It didn't die out, in fact. National Service didn't actually die out until 1960. I only missed it by a gnat's.
Oh, thank God. Can't imagine you enjoying it that much.
Well, actually, quite a lot
maybe
of people...
Maybe you would have.
Quite a lot of people did. Mm. I mean, for some people, particularly from the East End, it was a terrifying experience. The first time they've ever been away from their mother.
Mm.
You know, they literally used to lie in bed in their dormitories screaming.
Mm.
You know, they were so homesick. And it was a very... In a way, a lot of people now would argue it's probably a good thing to have done. But actually, it was a shock to the system. Anyway, Reggie and Ronnie did not respond well to National Service. They, believe it or not, were asked to enlist at the Tower of London, which they duly did.
Were they beef eaters?
No. They were joining the Royal Fusiliers.
Oh.
But in fact, they were there for about 7 minutes, and immediately left. They didn't think they had to stay. They thought, oh, well, I've done that now. I'm off. Oh, they had. I mean, they were arrested, taken back to the army. The army eventually put them in army prison. They were just incredibly rebellious. I mean, they were literally... They dumped a tiern over one corporal's head. And they were just simply out of control, completely uncontrollable. And not surprisingly, this involved them being eventually dishonorably discharged, but not before they'd been court-martialed, not before they'd been sent to army prison, not before they'd... I mean, they just caused chaos. And eventually, after the dishonourable discharge, they served the rest of their time in a civilian prison. They were let out away from an army jail. They went to a civilian prison. Well, the only thing you can say is it absolutely convinced them there was no point in towing the line. There was no point in being respectful or respectable. I don't think they really ever wanted to be. Now, before you ask me, I think it's probably important to say that they had what might be described as an incestuous relationship. The speculation about their sexuality is absolutely legendary. But what is pretty clear is that the intensity of their relationship was probably a result of them both being to some extent gay. As we would now say.
I mean, twins can have very strong bonds, can't they?
Yes.
Not unusual.
No. How many twins do you know? Do I know any?
I don't know many twins. Catherine Lewis is a twin. Moggy Lewis.
Oh, that's right.
School. She was a twin.
Yes. They have this extraordinary relationship, don't they? It's almost intuitive. Mm. Empathy.
And it can be very significant and strong for certain twins.
Yes, well, I think it would be fair to say that the relationship between Ronnie and Reggie was incredibly strong.
Mm.
And, I mean, essentially, in the wake of their very unsuccessful national service, or shall we say successful for them, but not successful for the army, they realised that they were not cut out for, quotes, a job, and they were cut out for something else. It's also important to say that because of Violet's, that's their mother's father, who is a man called, believe it or not, Jimmy Cannonball Lee, they had both been very successful amateur boxers as young men.
So they could, quotes, look after themselves.
Quotes, look after themselves. They could indeed. And which meant, in fact, that, however, that the possibility of a further career in amateur boxing was rather blighted by their, how can I put it, spotty record of national service. So they gave up boxing. Incidentally, they were very competitive with one another. One of the fascinating things about them is they were intensely competitive. If one boxed one person, the other would want to beat him. They were very, very competitive. It's that closeness that you were talking about a moment or two ago. And they turned to a life of crime. We're talking about the 1950s. We're talking about 1954, 55. And one of the first things they did was they purchased a rundown snooker club in Mile End, which they used as a front for all manner of nefarious activities, including protection racket, money laundering, fencing stolen goods. They were making a living, but they were also, and I think that's the important thing, and for people now probably don't recognise it, they were also creating a reputation. They were East End hard men. Ronnie, in particular, I think Ronnie famously, when they were first, they first endeavoured to get them back into the army, Ronnie punched the corporal so hard he broke his jaw and it fell over.
No, it would.
I mean, they were intimidating. Ronnie was slightly bigger than Reggie. But neither of them small, but Ronnie was the biggest and in many ways the most threatening.
Was he the mad one?
Let's get to that.
I know you'll get to that.
Let's get to that. But in 1960, after this launching of a career in the second half of the 50s in the East End, Ronnie was sent to prison for protection. In other words, for threatening people and demanding money with threats. He was given 18 months. But at that point, Reggie, who was not sent to prison, was around, and a famous landlord, a notorious landlord called Peter Rackman, whom I think they were extorting. You know, we'll leave you alone unless you pay us regular large amounts of money. Rackman sold, quotes, Reggie a nightclub called Esmeralda's Barn. Now, nowadays, no one has ever remembers the name Esmeralda's Barn, but it was actually on the most fantastic site. It was where the Barclay Hotel is in Knightsbridge.
Oh.
It was a fantastic site. And all of a sudden, when Ronnie's back out of jail and Reggie's, they've started tarting up Esmeralda's Barn, they become part of the iconography of the swinging 60s. Everybody goes to Esmeralda's Barn.
Nice.
And it was extraordinary. I mean, there was no one who didn't go. I mean, Frank Sinatra, Judy Garland, Barbara Windsor, Diana Dawes, Jane Mansfield.
Oh, my word.
Peter Sellers. They were so famous that David Bailey, the
photographer,
took one of the really iconic images of them. They were real faces in the best sense of the word. Sammy Davis Jr., the Rat Pack, everybody wanted. They were prosperous, they were charming, but they were also gangsters.
Dangerous.
They had branched out into a touch of armed robbery, a bit of arson, and if push came to shove, a touch of murder. They were very, very dangerous. But they were still very celebrated.
And everyone knew that they were being like that.
I think a lot of people suspected it, but it, you know, you are talking about 1962, 63, 64, when suddenly, I mean, I went to university in London in 1962.
Did you go to Esmeralda's Barn?
I never went there, no. I'd like to have gone just to see what it was like. But I didn't, I was on a student grant, it didn't really run to that. But, so they were using Esmeralda's Barn and various other establishments to launder money, while at the same time running very effective protection rackets, and indeed a touch of armed robbery here and there and a bit of shifting stolen goods. And they were, but they had a swagger. I think that's the thing, that the only British gangsters that really bear comparison to the mafia in the United States. But they weren't Italian, or not Italian Americans. They were good old-fashioned East Enders.
Londoners.
They had an incredible swagger. Ronnie was usually regarded as the enforcer. He was, you know, more prone to violence than Reggie, but Reggie wasn't averse to violence himself. But what they did was they cast a great shadow across Central London, Swinging London, as it became known in 62. So much so that they came eventually to the attention of Scotland Yard. Hardly surprising. And in particular, a famous detective called Detective Superintendent Leonard, always known as Nipper Reed. The problem that the Yard had was that they were very well connected. So it wasn't just show business that went to Esmeralda's barn. It was MPs, it was members of the House of Lords, minor royalty. They were well connected. And that is important because it was pretty clear that Ronnie was having an affair with a member of the House of Lords called Lord Boothby.
Oh.
And in 1964, the Sunday Mirror ran a story suggesting that this relationship... Remember, at that point, homosexuality was still illegal in Britain.
Mm-hmm.
Was having an affair with Bob Boothby, which was... how can one put it? A sensation.
Yeah.
Boothby, famously bisexual, had been having an affair with Harold Macmillan's wife, the Prime Minister's wife at one point.
Busy man.
He was very flamboyant and a very public figure.
What was his name? Boothby.
Boothby. But the Sunday Mirror, having run the story, then got very cold feet, partly because of the Craze connections. The Mirror published a full-page apology and paid Boothby £40,000 in 1964, which would now be about $250,000. There was another angle to this, is that Ronnie was also reputed to be having an affair with a very famously gay Labour MP called Tom Dryburgh. So when the Labour Party came to power under Harold Wilson in 1964 and then won another election victory in 1966, there was not much impetus from the political classes to look into the Craze. Nipper Reed wanted to take action against them, but there was no sense in which the political class wanted that to happen. Wilson didn't want Dryburgh's gayness to be brought to the fore because it was still illegal. Boothby had already been apologised to. So there was a lot, that's the Tories.
Mm.
So neither the Tories nor the Labour Party at that point were in any way anxious to, how can I put it politely, stop the Craze. And so their, well, it's not rule of terror, it's more like rule of celebrity, continued. It rolled forward. Nipper Reed always wanted to put an end to the rule of the Cray twins, particularly in East London and in Central London. I think Ronnie at one point, when he wrote his book later, he said, "Me and my brother ruled London. We were untouchable." He actually used the word before untouchable, but I won't say that on the podcast. which they were. In many ways, they were so famous and so celebrated. When are we going to go? We're not going to turn against them. Also, there was that omerta, that rule of silence in the East End. That
you don't rat.
You don't rat on anybody.
No snitches.
No snitching.
Snitches get stitches.
Yes, indeed. And then in 1966, in March 1966, comes probably the most famous gangland killing in British criminal history. It's the 9th of March 1966, and a man called George Cornell is drinking in the Blind Beggar Pub in Whitechapel on the Mile End Road. Now, we should now give you a bit of background. There were two really fierce gangs in London at that point, the Richardsons in South London and the Craze in East and Central London. There was actually a third gang, but not quite as significant as either of those two. Now, the day before this famous event in the Blind Beggar, there had been a shootout, believe it or not, in a nightclub called Mr. Smith's in Catford, in which one of the Craze associates had been shot. Ronnie was not happy about this. And he discovers, he's drinking in another pub, of course, at that point. He discovers that Cornell, who's actually an enforcer, a hard man for the Richardsons, the South London gang, is drinking in the pub, the Blind Beggar. In the wake of the shooting at Mr. Smith's the day before, a lot of the Richardsons are arrested and they're in jail, but not Cornell, because he wasn't actually at Mr. Smith's that day. So Ronnie is told by a friend that Cornell is in the Blind Beggar. So Ronnie, bold as brass, broad daylight, with two friends, one is driver and an associate, walks into the Blind Beggar pub and shoots Cornell in the back of the head, killing him outright, instantly. Absolutely bang. And then one of the associates fires five shots into the ceiling to prevent anybody telling anybody. It is absolutely legendary event in history of British gangsters. Mm. Always known as the Blind Beggar. If you can drive past the Blind Beggar now, you can still go to the Blind Beggar. It's still there. But that, in a way, forever made the Craze famous. They were already famous as gangsters, but now they were also famous for killing Cornell in the Blind Beggar. And it somehow, I don't know, it was... Later, Ronnie was diagnosed as being a paranoid schizophrenic. But there's no doubt at all that he knew what he was doing when he killed Cornell. Mm. And indeed, they came up with an elaborate scheme to get somebody else to take the blame if anybody came to ask him about it. But it seemed to embolden them. So in December 1966, they decide to spring from Dartmoor prison an old associate called the Mad Axeman, or Frank Mitchell. He'd been complaining to his friends that he wasn't getting a fair deal, so they thought they were helping him, quotes. So they arranged for him to escape from Dartmoor. They had a very long reach. But the trouble is, he was very difficult and very volatile. And they then didn't know what to do with him. So they put him in a flat in East London. But he became increasingly difficult to handle. And how can one put it politely? He mysteriously disappeared. It was always said that eventually he'd got on their nerves and that they'd told someone to kill him. And they put him in the boot of the car and took him to the seaside and dumped him at sea. Mitchell was never seen again. He was actually quite a popular figure in the East End. So you've got this extraordinary thing that you can get away with whatever you want to. They kill Cornell in the Blind Beggar.
Yeah.
Frank Mitchell, the Mad Axeman, disappears. So now the Craze have committed two egregious acts. The killing of Cornell and the disappearance, and of course killing, of Frank Mitchell. It, in a way, establishes their notoriety among the criminal community in London and also at Scotland Yard. It's as if they believe they could get away with whatever they wanted.
Sounds like they could.
And in October 1967, they commit another crime. This time, Ronnie persuades Reggie to kill a fellow associate of the firm, because their gangster associates were known as the firm, who had not fulfilled a contract they'd asked him to do. His name was Jack the Hat McVitie. Ronnie said to Reggie, "You've got to kill McVitie." Ronnie fires at him with a revolver, but the revolver jams. And so they hand Reggie a carving knife, and he proceeds to stab McVitie in the face and neck. Now, I should add a little bit of, and this is, I'm nearly at the end of part one. I should add that this is just 4 months after Reggie's wife, Frances Shea, as she was known, was her maiden name, has died in what looked like suicide. He'd only been married for 18 months. The legend about what actually happened to Reggie's wife, Frances, first wife, is a manifold. Towards the end of his life, Reggie admitted to a fellow inmate in prison that Ronnie had killed her, probably out of jealousy. But the hold that Ronnie had over Reggie and Reggie had over Ronnie was unbreakable. So they've now committed the murder of George Cornell, the disappearance of Frank Mitchell, and the murder of Jack the Hat McVitie, which was in the end to see their downfall.
There you go, end of part one.
End of part one.
Wow. I actually didn't know any of that.
No,
I don't really like violence very much, ironically, for a person who does a
true crime podcast.
So I wouldn't watch a film or thing about them because I'm not very good with violence.
No, I'm perfectly reasonable, darling. I don't see any reason why you should.
So I didn't know that.
And I've always stayed away from it. But one of the things I've come to realise is something that I take absolutely for granted because I grew up, you know, in the 50s and 60s with the celebrity of the craze absolutely tattooed on my mind, is that people don't know now.
No.
It's a long time ago. Mm. You know, it's the dim and distant.
Yeah.
It should be said that when the Richardsons came to trial, which indeed they did, in the wake of the shooting in Mr. Smith's, it was one of the most
sensational
cases, because it had emerged they weren't averse to a good deal of torture. They would connect to...
Yeah, that's the sort of thing I can't...
Yes. It kept the papers happy for weeks, the Richardson's trial. But anyway, so Ronnie and Reggie go on. And so what we'll do in part two is what happened next.
What happened next? Thanks, Dad. That's cool. Nice.
Have you had a good week? What have you done? Anything exciting?
I've been to a lot of screenings.
Oh, gosh. What have you seen?
I saw a show for Sky called Then You Run, which is not coming out till the end of February 2023. And I saw the first two episodes of the second series of Professor T, which should start on ITV on the 16th of September.
Okay.
Starring two of my clients, Barney White and Emma Naomi. And it's got Ben Miller in it.
Okay.
And did you watch the first season? Probably
yes.
Not.
You I did?
Yeah, it's taken from a Belgian format. So it's police detectives and then there's an OCD forensic criminology lecturer at a high-level university who comes in to help them solve the crimes. It's not rocket science, but, you know, it does...
No, it works.
It works. It does what it says on the tin. It's charming.
Good. Well, that's... What could be better?
Nothing.
Very nice.
Very good.
Well, shall we just remind people how to get in touch with us again?
Yes, although you're going to have to be in charge of the Instagram now because I've come off Instagram.
Yeah, I'll be in charge as best I can. But I'll need instruction about how to do it.
I know. So Dad will be in charge of Instagram. So, and you can email us on bloodties.podcast@gmail.com. I sometimes take a while to check it, but I do get there eventually. So just bear with. Our Instagram handle is bloodties_pod. And Geoffrey, you can find through his website, geoffreywanter.com.
Yes. And do, as ever, please contact us if you have suggestions.
Suggestions.
Thoughts.
I actually probably need to give you a whole raft of suggestions.
Okay.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you to all the people that help us, our producer Sam Brain, my brother Dan, who did the music, my friend George, who drew our caricature, to Audio Boom for hosting us, to Geoffrey for all the hard work, and to you, the listeners, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, and hope you've enjoyed our return, and do be careful out there.